Don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The April 19th, 2017 episode is an abridged rerun of episode 104, originally recorded on October 20th, 2014 at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. On that episode, Nate joins me for a wide-ranging discussion of interventions, interference, and invasions. We look at historical relations with Cuba, the CIA's history with rebellions, the future of military interventions, and more. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
So Nate and I are going to be discussing today the sort of broad topic with a lot of history and current events mixed in of interventions, interference, and invasions. You know, obviously we've got this intervention going on in Syria and Iraq right now. There's been calls for similar interventions in other places. But interestingly, there's actually been a couple of sort of historical topics related to that back in the news. Cuba, for example, is the one we're going to start out with, and then we're going to talk about the CIA studies on their record with armed rebellions. The Cuba one, basically what happened there was that, I don't have the name of the author in front of me, but they wrote up in the New York Times a review of some recently declassified documents from the Kissinger files. Basically, Henry Kissinger, I think most people know, is the former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. He was in, you know, various roles in the Nixon and Ford administrations and remains a very prominent figure. Anyway, he didn't comment at all on the release of these documents, but that, you know, periodically every few years more documents get released from his time in that job or those two jobs. And the most recent release was essentially this thing that revealed that if Jimmy Carter hadn't been elected in 1976, that the U.S. very well might have attempted to go to war with Cuba again, and possibly even with the Soviet Union. And obviously that's a pretty alarming thing, and hopefully somebody would have eventually said, no, this is super crazy. But by the accounts that we've gotten, early in 1976, President Ford had basically signed off preliminarily anyway on coming up with the plan that would happen after he was elected, if he was elected to his own term in November of 1976, which he ended up not being because Jimmy Carter won. And you might be wondering, well, what the heck was the reason for this? I mean, you know, at the same time that this is going on, this is right after the Vietnam War, which basically more or less ended in a disaster for the U.S. I mean, we sort of just barely got out.
I think it's safe to call it a disaster at this point.
And then Kissinger and Nixon and everybody had been working really hard on trying to open up relations with China, get closer to them, both diplomatically and make, you know, economic inroads if possible. And obviously that particular policy seems to have really worked out over the long run, but probably a lot of other Kissinger policies, not so much. And so, you know, as they're working on this rapprochement with communist China, we're finding out, oh, but there was this plan for, you know, going to war with communist Cuba. Well, that's kind of crazy. As it turns out, it's even crazier than that, because he was apparently secretly trying to negotiate for a similar deal with Cuba to try to kind of break them away from the Soviet Union's influence and bring them back under the, you know, sort of traditional American influence, or at least get to a place of relative harmony in this region, because obviously Cuba is very close to the United States. States. And then he got really angry because they intervened militarily in the Angola Civil War. Now, at the time that they started making this plan, it was a relatively small-scale intervention, but then it rapidly escalated. So, you know, for those who don't know the whole deal with Angola, basically what happened there was that this was a Portuguese colony, and Portugal tried to hold on very, very long to its colonies, like all the way to the 1970s, essentially. The regime in Portugal didn't want to give this up. Then suddenly, in 1975, the regime is overthrown in what's called the Carnation Revolution, which is a military coup by a left-wing group of military officers who then transition the country to democracy. Now, for Portugal, that worked out great, pretty much. I mean, it was a little bit bumpy, but more or less worked out that whole transition. One of the primary objectives of this revolution was the immediate end of the Portuguese colonial system. And they just wanted to leave immediately. They did not want to do a transition plan. They did not want to stick around. They just wanted to pack up and go. And so there's the situation going on in Guinea-Bissau. There was a situation in Mozambique. And there was a situation in Angola. Those are the three major colonies that were still in Africa under the, you know, Portuguese control. And Angola already had three different groups, well, maybe even four, but three major groups that were fighting for independence and not working with each other. And Portugal said, okay, well, let's try to leave, like, somewhat reasonably, right? But you guys have to come up with a plan for who's going to be in charge, because we're not going to sort this out for you. And so they came up with some deal where there was going to be a power sharing agreement between these three, you know, rebel groups that were all backed by different factions, or sort of backed by different factions. And the problem is, once Portugal was going to be out of the picture, then every other, you know, power that was meddling around started thinking, well, how can I get in on this action? And they all backed different sides. And Portugal ended up basically just saying, okay, whoever's in charge of the capital on the day that we've designated to hand over control gets control of the capital. The end. Goodbye. And that's what they did. And so immediately this civil war goes from pretty bad to super crazy escalated. And so the Soviets back one side and the Chinese back another side because they want to oppose the Soviets, and the US backs another side and South Africa's backing one of them. So it ends up being that the Soviets and the Cubans are supporting one group, the Chinese and a bunch of other African countries are supporting another group, and then the US and apartheid South Africa are supporting this third one.
That's a good bedfellow to be in with.
Right. Exactly. And apartheid South Africa was also illegally occupying what's now Namibia, which is next to Angola. And so they ended up sending ground troops. We sent the CIA. Castro started sending supplies and then doing these huge, like, crazily intense air missions where they had to, like, limit the weight of the planes as much as possible, put on as many fuel tanks as they could, and fly nonstop from Cuba to Angola with no Soviet support initially, so that they could drop off weapons and trainers. And they set up all these academies to train, you know, these guerrilla fighters. And then they actually ended up sending, you know, over the course of 1976, after this plan was devised, they sent like tens of thousands of Cuban soldiers who were very enthusiastic, apparently, to go fight in Angola. So pretty crazy situation. And as Nate said, not a great combo of people to be working with, because the only reason that South Africa was involved was because they wanted a, you know, a white buffer zone or whatever to protect their system. But anyway, so this is the crazy context of what's going on in 1976. Just nuts situation. And apparently he's like, we should go to war with Cuba. And then even saying, and this probably means going to war with the Soviets too. So Nate, what was your reaction to this, you know, revelation?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that we've known that Kissinger was kind of itching to do for years, really, when he was in, you know, sort of his position of power in the State Department. He was always looking to do. I mean, I don't think it sat well at any point with sort of the, you know, whether it's the realists or the, you know, of course, Kissinger is the arch realist, but there's no doubt that he did have some of this same, not exactly the same as the neoconservative urgency to change regimes in other country, but I don't think it sat well. Stronghold of Soviet power basically on our doorstep, and they were looking pretty much from the moment Fidel Castro got into power to find some way to take him out, whether it was, you know, exploding cigars, exploding sea conch shells on the beach, trying to poison him, you know, trying to invade with, you know, your various Miami
dissidents.
Yeah, exactly. Or whether it's drawing up plans to nuke them, or, you know, what have you. So it's not too surprising, but it is good to see some documents coming out that actually show us, you know, the backroom planning and all that. You know, we have some sort of plan to attack every country, including Canada, I think. So, I mean, we did try to attack Canada several times in the past, but
a long time ago.
We don't have to go quite that far back into it.
But yeah, no, so I agree with your take on it, which is that I think that, he, you know, as evidenced by the fact that he first tried to make a rapprochement with Cuba and then suddenly pivoted to wanting to wipe them off the face of the earth with nuclear weapons, I think that it's clear that he wasn't concerned about changing the regime because he wanted to bring democracy to Cuba. He just didn't want this Soviet outpost in, you know, the US's backyard, basically. And he also was just really angry that they dared to meddle with the world order that he was trying to build, you know, across Africa or wherever. You know, I mean, it's just, it's really strange though, too, because it's not like they came up with this plan kind of not really thinking through the implications. According to the documents, there's indications that they had specific knowledge or accepted or acknowledged that the assault might fail to topple the regime, that it would probably result in the destruction or abandonment of the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, that we would then have to spend a huge amount of money and effort moving everything in the Caribbean, that part of our military, over to Puerto Rico and reopening a bunch of bases there, which would cause various other issues. And this was all without even the Soviet Union getting involved, right? That this amazing plan, not even a Bay of Pigs style plan, which just, that was flat out terrible to begin with, but this level of thinking out this plan of like a full-scale attack on Cuba might still result in the U.S. losing to Cuba, essentially. Short of actually just hydrogen bombing the entire island, I guess. I mean, at this point, you got to ask yourself, how real are the realists even being anyway? Sometimes it seems like they get a little bit too wrapped up in their Machiavellian whatevers and revenge plans to actually think clearly about what stuff you want to just let slide and what stuff you need to take head on. And this was, I mean, if you think about it, this was something like less than 15 years after the Bay of Pigs disaster. I mean, there's just this long legacy of trying to do these interventions. The U.S. embargo on Cuba is still going to this day. But, you know, obviously, Nate, I know you know that this as well as anybody, but there's the sort of this ongoing lobby in the Cuban-American community and political community, which they're quite politically active, to keep this embargo going. I mean, is there any case to be made at this point for keeping the embargo going?
I mean, I certainly won't make one. It seems like the Obama administration was initially starting to take steps. I think there was like a travel restriction that was adjusted.
Yeah, they eased the travel ban.
Yeah, so I mean, I think they are looking towards it, but obviously, you know, 60 years of policy doesn't get changed in, you know, a couple of days. It's weird that like Beyonce and Jay-Z can go to Cuba, but I can't really, you know, there's... Or maybe I could if I like fly to Canada first and, you know, figure out that all that stuff. But if I'm trying to like start up a business and trying to, you know, actually have a flow of goods with Cuba, which I'm sure that there would be a pretty lucrative market. I mean, just trying to think about it, just since we've had this trade embargo for so long, it seems like there's probably, you know, niche markets where people maybe haven't necessarily been exposed to certain American goods that you could go in and sell in Cuba. So, I mean, it kind of seems like there's a lot of potential for an economic opportunity there. And, I mean, especially when you think back, like, back in the days when, like, you know, what is it, 30s, 40s, 50s, Cuba was sort of like the Las Vegas of the Caribbean. So if we go back to that sort of situation or something where, you know, Cuba gets developed and, you know, it becomes a destination for, you know, tourism, it can, you know, just improve the economy in general, get business starting to develop there. So, you know, hopefully at some point it'll just be, it won't be like the 51st state imagined by maybe some southern slaveholders at one point, but maybe it almost feel like that, like it's a pretty, you know, normal place where people go on vacation. I mean, this is just hoping, projecting 50 years in the future, that maybe at some point it'll be like, okay, where are we going to go for our vacation? Are we going to go to the Virgin Islands? Are we going to go to the Bahamas? Are we going to go to Cuba? Are we going to, you know, Haiti, Dominican Republic, you know, somewhere in Central America? Just becomes one of those places, and because of the rich history and, you know, vibrancy of the Cuban culture, probably a pretty popular place to go. So, you know, I just think that there's a tremendous opportunity that we've pretty much been ignoring for about 60 years at this point.
Now, politically, do you think that the embargo has weakened or strengthened the position of the Castro regime?
Probably strengthened it, right? I mean, it's not like we've destroyed their economy or anything to the, like, completely in a sense that, you know, there's mass starvation on the streets and people are turning against the regime or anything like that. I mean, probably people have been annoyed with it and, you know, maybe consequently annoyed with the Castro regime just because, you know, it has had an impact on their lives for so long at this point. But, I mean, I don't think it's turned people completely against them. I don't know.
I mean, my guess is, and I admit to not having that much familiarity with it, but my guess is that it made people more dependent on the government instead of less dependent.
Well, usually with those kind of things, that's sort of how it works, you know, where it's just the more that another, like, outside power is coming to, like, squeeze economic influence on you, the more that maybe... And sometimes we see this with, like, Iran, you know, it's economic sanctions are great, but, you know, if they're not necessarily changing the outcome of the regime's behavior, and at the same time, they're also not engendering goodwill towards you amongst, like, the normal person on the street, then it can be counterproductive.
Another thing that just really puzzles me about this is that every time you get the arguments about this is a repressive regime and, you know, human rights abuses and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, but what about all the countries that we're allies with that do that too, if not worse? I mean, I'm not sure how this embargo is supposed to cure these human rights abuses or whatever, you know, or as you said, change the behavior of the regime. I mean, if that's the argument, why are we not putting sanctions on, you know, Saudi Arabia or Egypt or whatever? Like, how is that the argument for...
Because we want their exports, Bill. It would not be beneficial to us to put an embargo on them. So that's probably why. I mean, less to do with any sort of, like... I love, like, the ideas that realists have when they talk about, like, oh, everything is, like, motivated by self-interest and, oh, it's all rational and states are the ultimate actors. Just, like... That's not actually how things work a lot of the time, and it just seems like incredibly simplistic to boil things down to just, I mean, that. States and groups act in all sorts of different ways that may be motivated by what they perceive as their self-interest, but really are the confluence of a lot of different factors and outside pressures that, you know, wouldn't necessarily be the correct course of action from a maybe omnipotent sort of, like, you know, bird's eye view of, you know, everything that's going on. But not to get too...
The omniscient narrator of international relations.
Well, I mean, you just see nations do things that are just so self-evidently stupid a lot of the time, and you're just like, okay. I mean, that's not what I'd do if I was playing in Civ 5. I can tell you that for sure. So.
Right. They're rational governments, rational leaders, and they still do stupid things.
Well, and even when they think they're acting rationally, it's like, okay, maybe, but yeah. I mean, I don't agree. So.
And it's also, you're always acting with incomplete information. That's part of the problem with the rational actor argument, you know, whether it's in economics or international relations or whatever, always presumes that you have, like, a, you know, that you're acting based on the best information that you have and that your information's reasonably good. But, like, I mean, with that Angola thing, like, we didn't even know that the Soviets weren't supporting the Cuban intervention for the first, like, year or so. They eventually did, but, you know, initially it was totally unconnected from Moscow's authority at all. This was just an idea that Fidel Castro came up with. Apparently, from reading some of the Wikipedia page stuff, he was so obsessed with the conflict in Angola that he had maps all over his offices of different jungle outpost areas in Angola. You know, this is the progress of the such and such movement today, and the front whatever over here is doing this thing, and, you know, South African troops have been spotted here, and CIA officers over here, and, like, he knew all these details. It was just like, well, don't you have your own country to be running? But, you know, I guess that was his pet project. So, but, you know, it's like everyone acts with different levels of information. And even when you have good information, you can just make super stupid decisions. But, you know, on that note, and also on, you know, what we've just been talking about, coming up after the break, our next segment is going to be about a more recent decision. Stick with us. We're going to talk about the legacy of CIA interventions, whether they're in Angola or Afghanistan or wherever, Cuba, I guess. And we're going to talk about how that worked or didn't work and, you know, what that means for, you know, modern U.S. policymaking. So Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. Democracy. This broadcast, episode 104, was originally recorded on October 20th, 2014, and re-edited on April 19th, 2017. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. With me in studio this week is Nate. We're talking this hour about interventions, interference, and invasions. And this particular segment, we've just been talking about Cuba, but this segment we're going to be talking about CIA interventions in general, and specifically the topic of arming rebellions that are in progress. Now, President Obama reportedly, according to the New York Times, asked the CIA to do an internal review, basically look over the whole history of the CIA since the late 1940s when it was established, and figure out in their entire history of, you know, arming one side of a conflict, what was the outcome of that, how much impact did it have, and did it, you know, accomplish the U.S. goals, etc. According to what we know of these classified reviews, some of it's been kind of leaked out and some of it's been hinted at in the media. According to what we know, the ultimate conclusion was that they could come up with a variety of examples where the CIA provided weapons to a repressive regime, like initially their first ever mission was to supply weapons to the Greek sort of military government or dictatorship after World War II so they could fight communist rebels. Those operations worked. Giving weapons to the existing power structure helped those power structures remain in power, and those were able to win their civil wars. However, in the cases of arming rebels, there has essentially been, out of all the different examples, you know, we talked about the one in Angola, for example. We talked about various other ones. You know, there's the Bay of Pigs and everything. In a case where there was like a civil conflict, civil war, and the CIA armed the rebels, there was only one case where it made any difference over the long run, changed the outcome of the war, and succeeded in its short-term goal. And that was providing the Mujahideen with weapons in 1980s Afghanistan to take out the Soviets. That was the one example that was a quote-unquote success.
I would actually disagree with that. I would say the Operation PB's success in Guatemala was a success in the sense that they destabilized and overthrew the government instead of a military junta. I would say that's a success when you evaluate it by was it a successful operation, not so much whether was it a operation that improved the livelihoods of the, you know.
Right. Well, okay. But were those quote-unquote freedom fighter rebels or were they the military people trying to seize power?
I mean, when you say military junta, it's, you know, it's the military. It's yeah. not, you know, you're so, a freedom fighter rebel types.
Right. And I think this is the distinction there is that when they're aiding the military sort of power structure, whether it's an existing dictatorship or trying to set up
one. United Fruit Company is also heavily involved in this whole right. operation as well. So, you know, between their land and, you know, the military interest trying to protect it and, you know, that's sort of how everything formulates there. People should look up this example. President Jabuka Arbenz was leftist aligned, but not necessarily particularly communist. And the wonderful CIA administration of Dulles decided that it would be a good idea to, you know, just get stuck in there a little bit, you know, get some bombing runs, you know, get some, you know, ex-Soviet weapons sent over in order to help out. So I think everything went really well. There was war there for a couple decades afterwards. You know, 100,000 people died. It's all par for the course. Central.
Chalk it up as a win.
Central American juntas and death squads and all sorts of stuff. Stuff like yeah. that. I mean, it would qualify as, I guess, technically a success if we were just looking
right.
at did they topple the government.
But in
same
terms
with
of
Iran.
The, yeah, in terms of the freedom fighters, though, overthrowing a, you know, repressive regime or occupying force, that we've only got the Afghanistan example, essentially. And that one didn't really turn out that well, given that it created the conditions for the Taliban and then hosting 9/11 planners.
Well,
and all
yeah.
that.
Well,
but
usually when I think of the U.S. arming people overseas, it's rarely the actual freedom fighters that they're arming. Usually they're arming, you know, the military that's aggressively putting down the freedom fighters, or
and those have worked out very well.
They're arming the government, which is usually crypto fascist, you know, sort of right wing like military, you know, with all the medals and feathers and hats and stuff, and they're usually fighting some, you know, Che Guevara esque guys in rags running around in the jungle with like AKs and stuff. So I mean, there haven't been too many instances of quote-unquote arming the rebels, but I would like to talk about one of them, one that was a tremendous failure. So in Indonesia, this is mid-1950s, you had a guy come to power called Sukarno, and you know, he was a very prominent nationalist leader, basically went along with the Japanese and was found himself in a decent position following the end of World War II, and started constructing the country. You know, he's the president and all that. So there was various disputes over, and we all know Indonesia is a bunch of islands, some very large, but the country had some various internal disputes between people on some of the more outlying islands, you know, and they wanted more central power, and there were various arguments like that. And of course, the U.S. is very interested in the situation because Indonesia is a giant country, obviously. U.S. concerned about Pacific control, also This time the U.S. is trying to go out there and like develop all these countries so that they can be loyal to the U.S. rather than the Soviets. And so they're sending various agricultural plans, trying to exploit the resources, you know, whether it's gold, palm oil, regular types of oil, different trees. Rubber is a big export of Indonesia. So the U.S. is very alert to Indonesia. And basically a situation develops in which several of these generals and almost, not even generals, they're colonels from the army in these outlying islands decide they're going to start a rebellion against Sukarno. And it's almost not even a rebellion to start off with. They're sort of just discussing and they're airing their grievances, things like that. And because the U.S. is a little concerned about Sukarno, he started buying weapons from the Soviets, really only because we wouldn't sell any weapons to him because we were afraid he was going to use them to attack part of New Guinea, which was still controlled by the Dutch at that time. We were at NATO and at the UN trying to appease the Dutch colonialists. So we're not selling Sukarno any weapons. So he buys them from, I think, the Czechs, or it might be just directly from the Soviets. So, you know, at that point, everyone's freaking out in the U.S. Really, that was all of our own doing, that he went and bought them from the Soviets because we had refused to sell him any weapons. So at that point, we start supplying weapons to these colonels. And it's really very little. The weapons supply aren't enough. But at the same time, you will have U.S.-trained generals in the main Indonesian army that are taking out the now U.S.-funded colonels who are basically, you know, have very little to work with. And, you know, you have these guys that went over and trained at, you know, the West Point, U.S. Naval Academy, and various American higher learning institutions, and actually have a pretty decent idea of what they're doing. And so basically the entire rebellion just fails miserably. You have basically the U.S. Navy and Eisenhower wondering whether they should send in troops, like American troops, to help assist because things have gone so wrong. But eventually things collapse so fast that you've got CIA agents having to flee into the jungle and get picked up by submarines because they're afraid that they're going to get, you know, captured by the Indonesian military. And pretty much all of their supporters had, you know, abandoned and fled off into the jungle also, and, you know, dropped their guns on the ground. So, I mean, that's just one example of when arming the rebels goes wrong. I mean, I did a lot of research into this just for a project I did in school, so there's obviously a lot more detail than what I just said here, but I mean, that's sort of the long and short of it is, you know, trying to get involved, trying to put our influence on another country, and pretty much things just end up worse than before. Eventually, Sukarno is overthrown, Suharto's put in, then you've got, with some decent U.S. support, and then, you lead to a situation where I think it was over 100,000 people suspected to be pro-communist were massacred. It went from bad to worse, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a fundamental misreading of the situation, as seems to happen a lot. We just don't seem to do our research. And, you know, like Nate said about kind of dragging these things out and causing lots of misery and stuff, I mean, that's what a lot of these studies on civil wars have found. Whether or not there's CIA involvement or anything like that, the overwhelming research, I think The Economist had some huge feature on the sort of literature that exists out there at this point on civil wars. Basically, the findings were such that a civil war generally only really changes the situation if it ends very rapidly. Like, say the situation in, it's a little bit complicated with the situation in Libya. Obviously, that kind of is still ongoing. But the actual civil war in the spring of 2011, that basically went from March of 2011 to August of 2011. And then there was a regime change. And so if you just look at that part of it, that meets the criteria. And that's less than 6 months. That's the thing, is that these things, basically 6 to 9 months is about the range where if you don't win in that time, it's not going to change the situation, and it's either going to result in a government victory eventually, or it's going to result in something that drags on for decades. The very few exceptions are like Sri Lanka, where the government eventually in 2006 basically just went in and massacred like tons of people until the rebellion was over, and that was after several decades of fighting. And, you know, there's still various lingering problems there, but they're, you know, the war is over essentially. The problem is, essentially, by the time that the U.S. government or whoever shows up, even if this is a perfectly legitimate civil war, perfectly, you know, this fight, gotta support them, whatever, by the time they arrive, usually it's already dragged on so long that this isn't gonna make a difference. And instead of helping these so-called freedom fighters topple the regime eventually probably wins out in every case except, I guess, like Afghanistan, basically. And then, but in the meantime, you've dragged out the like misery and the awfulness and the massacres and the, you know, civilian casualties on either side and all the horrible things that are associated with a huge civil war like that. You've got to finish it quickly, or else it just goes on, and the CIA or whoever intervening tends to just drag it out. It doesn't fix the situation. It just makes the same outcome come years later at a much greater cost. And the persistent fear is, oh, well, if we don't do this, then the government's going to go in and massacre everyone as retribution. Well, they're probably going to massacre everyone in retribution either way, and they're actually probably less likely to do it if they can end the war quickly. I mean, you got cases like in Guinea-Bissau when they had a civil war in like 98, 99 or whatever. I think that civil war lasted for about 9 months or something, and there were some casualties, like civilian casualties, but relative to like most African civil wars, it was over like that. They said, okay, well, now we're done fighting, and everyone just went back to what they were doing. Like, there wasn't like a whole ongoing thing. And that's the thing. If you just drag this out, you're just going to make everyone more and more miserable. And so, you know, I kind of don't understand why President Obama commissions this study to review the CIA's track record, concludes initially, yeah, it looks like it's been basically a failure, then authorizes some weapons transfers anyway, and then says, because of ISIS, oh, we're going to train these rebels, we're going to vet and train rebels to fight in Syria against ISIS and, I guess, the Syrian government. I mean, the Syrian government is winning. They're going to win. That's the outcome. Short of an actual, you know, invasion or straight up bombing the regime or whatever, we know the outcome of the civil war at this point in Syria. It's just a question of how much longer this is going to drag on. And the only thing that's going to drag it on longer is outside extensions of it. And that, to me, seems like a worse outcome for the people on the ground than if this war just ended.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing that the Obama administration should take away from reviewing some of their government's previous foreign dalliances, maybe, way to put it, it's just that we're not, whether, okay, stepping away from like, okay, is it effective or like what outcome does like arming the rebels actually have? Because obviously, you know, every situation is a little different and the strengths and weaknesses of the various groups could end up, you know, influencing the outcome there. But we're not even arming the right people. We're not even attempting to go and find and understand the people that actually have a common ground with the United States and have share our values. It's which group is marginally aligned more with our interests and marginally shares our values in the sense that they believe rather than communism, they maybe believe in capitalism or like don't care enough about communism to support it. So, I mean, because I doubt any of these, you know, right-wing rebels are particularly, capitalist entrepreneurs, you know, they love the invisible hand and just like worship.
Yeah, they're more fascist than anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Else,
they're very military-based, you know, just authoritarian. Sort of that vision of loyalty, but you know, it just, and then on the flip side, so we're arming these types of guys, basically, especially when you go into everything that happened in Central America, even up to the 80s, you know, you have various just like straight up death squads, guys who would probably be pretty at home in just sort of like a Einsatzgruppen type situation where their job is to kill people. Those are the people that we're funding, not necessarily democratic organizations or, you know, local activists that are, well, of course, those people might necessarily be have some leftist inspired ideas, so we can't necessarily go at funding them.
Right. I mean, it's crazy that all these proxy wars during the Cold War were supposedly about freedom and democracy or whatever. Oh, but the democratic activists are too communitarian and they like to work together in an egalitarian manner. That sounds like Marxism. Yeah, duh. Well, you know what else sounds like Marxism? Democracy. I mean, you know, there's differences, but like in terms of who's more aligned with what, like it was just such a misreading of the situation.
We're overthrowing the people that are sharing our value. You know, Mossadegh, okay, wouldn't be a Republican here in the United States, but I don't think he was a full-on communist either. And the fact that we decided to take that action in Iran, overthrow him, well, we saw how that turned out. It's still going. You know, Iran probably is going to have nuclear weapons pretty soon. And their people have suffered through about, was it 40, 50, 60 years now of various torture, killings by the Shah, you know, not being able to, you know, live in the 21st century under the, you know, current Islamic Republic. So it's just, it's not been a good situation. You just have to wonder if we had taken maybe different steps back in the 50s, would things be like this right now in Iran?
And the stupidest part of it, of course, is that, you know, even as we were overthrowing socialist-aligned moderates in places like Iran, we were backing socialist moderates in Western Europe because that was the alternative to the communists. And most of them, they still have, you know, center-left social democratic governments or at least major political parties in those countries. So it was apparently, there was a scale of acceptability where it was, oh, it's okay over here, but it's not okay over there because we trust the French to be socialist or right. We trust the Germans, West Germans to be socialist, but we don't trust the Iranians to be socialist because they're going to take the oil away from the British.
Well, I mean, this is exactly what I was talking about before when we talk about how the U.S. viewed post-Cold War policy a lot of times in the through the lens of development. And this is specifically what a class I had in college focused on, you know, this, like, professor drilled us into our heads every day with various types of books and stuff. But this was a major frame of how the U.S. approached post-World War II policy in the Third World, trying to develop these countries through its own model rather than the Soviet model and essentially bring them over to our side. So, you know, if you have a moderate leftist in power in Europe, that's maybe not as much of a concern because, you know, it's within our, you know, within our control. We had fairly solid control over parts of Europe by the time, obviously not Eastern Europe, but the French, I guess, we weren't too worried about them breaking off, more worried about, like, what exactly they're going to do relative to NATO.
We did force the communists out of the French government, though.
It just, we were extremely concerned about, you know, the vast masses of the Third World, and, you know, this is, the way the U.S. is viewing at the time is still very influenced by almost like a colonial mindset still, in the sense of how to view these, you know, just like great brown masses, like of like the unknown.
That they're all the same.
Well, that now that the U.S. is like almost assuming a responsibility and control over because they want to reshape the post-World War II globe in an image that is beneficial to the United States. So, I mean, I guess that would be my explanation as to why we were so hyper concerned about the leaders, you know, in Guatemala or Iran, or, you know, how relatively leftist they are, and maybe not as concerned about what the French were up to, just because I guess we assumed that we weren't necessarily going to lose them after bailing them out. I mean, that's just my explanation. Just there's a fair amount out there, and I guess it's being studied more and more now about how just the development aspect and almost like a neo-colonial aspect of how the U.S. viewed much of the Third World.
All right, well, we're going to take a break. Our next segment is going to be on the, you know, the wider future of these sort of interventions and, you know, what we might be looking for, you know, not just from the United States, but from other countries in general. What's the outlook on that? So stick around, and we'll be right back with that in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. This broadcast, episode 104, was originally recorded on October 20th, 2014, and re-edited on April 19th, 2017. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. In studio with me is Nate. We've been talking this hour about interventions, interference, and invasions around the world. We started by talking about Cuba and a historical situation there. Then we moved to the sort of general view of CIA and U.S. military interventions and sort of aiding rebellions in various places. Or suppressing rebellions in various places, as the case may be. And we also talked about how this relates to the current debate on what the U.S. should be doing in Syria. I want to talk now about sort of the wider picture here, because obviously we've been mostly focusing on the United States, but this is something that's increasingly sort of looping in more and more countries. There was in, I would say, probably like the 1990s, this sort of surge among some international relations professors and researchers and things like that of promoting this idea that instead of having, you know, the UN do, you know, an intervention or the US alone or NATO or something like that, that it should be basically neighboring countries should intervene, or that neighboring regional groups should intervene. And
sounds like a throwback.
In defense of this theory, there were some successful examples of this, like how the brutal Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia was toppled by the, you know, communist government in Vietnam. obviously, the Vietnam example, I mean, it's held up now in retrospect as saying, well, it was a communist regime that toppled a brutal communist regime, and of course then replaced it with a different communist regime. You know, but this is supposedly an example of a positive neighborly intervention to rescue people, whatever. Let's just remember, though, that at the time, this intervention by Vietnam, the communist government in Vietnam, formerly North Vietnam, was vehemently opposed by the Margaret Thatcher government in Britain, the United States government in the Reagan administration. And we basically had said at that point that we were more willing to support the Khmer Rouge regime, also communists, in Cambodia, then side with the Vietnamese regime that we had been at war with. Anyway, so this theory emerged in the 1990s that maybe the solution shouldn't be these sort of Western, you know, almost neo-colonial interventions. Maybe the solution should be more neighborly. And we saw this emerge all over sub-Saharan Africa. And basically, they get a sort of legitimate veneer from the United Nations of saying, we're going to have this, like ECOWAS, which is the Economic Community of West African States, or similar, or the African Union, that they're going to intervene in this crisis, or they're going to go into Somalia, or wherever. And what has essentially happened with this is that, in fact, it's just like Nate said, it sounds like a throwback. It's exactly what it was under the Cold War era, with everyone meddling in each other's neighboring affairs, except that now it's somehow legitimized by the international community.
Well, I was going to say it sounds like more actually like a throwback to maybe more like the 1600s or something, where some sort of crisis or event in one country, and, you know, you've got a couple other countries, you know, come pile in, steal their land, you know, basically wipe them off the map, you know, a la Poland or something like that.
Where Europe did that, yeah.
Basically, they just took off chunks of Poland until there was nothing left. So, I mean, it's not a terrible idea. I'm just saying it's not necessarily one that's going to lead to, you know, the nations with the best interests of the poor people in the other country at heart.
I think that on paper, it makes some amount of sense, in the sense that they probably have a better idea of what the local dynamics are and, you know, the situation than, say, sending in Bangladeshi peacekeepers to the middle of Africa or something like that, or a, you know, white neo-colonial guy from Western
Europe.
But
I wouldn't necessarily say the African Union did a bang-up job at preventing the, you know, the Darfur situation.
No, certainly not.
And they sent peacekeepers there, but it's not like it.
And the other thing is that we've seen, like I said, this has basically just been an opportunity for everyone to intervene in everyone else's business. I mean, it's great if you send South African troops to, you know, the post-apartheid South African troops to something in Central Africa or something like that. But it's a little bit less great if you're sending Kenyan troops to Somalia, basically next door. You know, in Kenya's case, they literally have like a clear conflict of interest there. Their argument, as with Ethiopia, which did it unilaterally without anybody's permission, they say, well, this, you know, chaos and crisis here affects us, so we should, you know, go in and try to stabilize the situation. But it tends to more often just work out to be like the Liberian and Sierra Leone conflicts basically spilling over into each other's countries and becoming staging areas for their reciprocal violence and blah, blah, blah. And then everything just goes to hell and it's terrible and everyone dies. It's really bad when that happens. And we see that kind of thing happening a lot. I mean, Chad has now emerged as a major military power in the middle of Africa, and they basically just send troops into all of their neighboring countries at the drop of a hat until it becomes inconvenient for them and they get attacked too much and then they leave. But they do that just to kind of like assert influence over the neighboring countries without actually really solving the problem. And we see this repeated time and again all over sub-Saharan Africa. Let's take another example. France intervening in, not very effectively, in the Central African Republic, somewhat more effectively in Mali. This is at the very beginning of 2013. And, you know, they did airstrikes there, halted this advancing, you know, Islamist militia that was moving in from the north. And then they put troops on the ground, sort of stabilized the situation. There's obviously now UN peacekeepers there and ongoing kind of low levels of violence. But they at least short term accomplished their goal of preventing the creation of, you know, this terrorist state in the heart of West Africa. But why did they intervene there? Because this was part of the same conflict that was threatening their uranium mines in Niger, another former French colony. And in Niger, you know, that's supplying the uranium for all these nuclear power plants in France, which produce 80% of the electricity in metropolitan France. And so they keep on showing up in all these former colonies, or in some cases, former Belgian colonies that speak French. And And it's, you know, they've gone back and forth internally in France as to how much of an activist role they should play. Traditionally, they used to have a policy that they would only back dictators, but now they have this more like pseudo-humanitarian thing, right? And then they also announced in May of 2014 that they were going to create a rapid reaction force of French troops stationed at like six different bases all over West Africa in, you know, like Mali and Niger. And I think maybe, I don't know the exact countries, but basically that they could stage quick, I called it the whack-a-mole strategy of being able to suddenly respond to a terrorist uprising or a hostage crisis. They have them a lot with Algeria, basically, the terrorists in southern Algeria kidnapping French citizens. And, you know, to me, this just seemed like a real neo-colonial throwback. And so that doesn't really seem like a great strategy either. And then getting back to the sort of neighborly interventions I've been kind of tracking, and Egyptian UAE airstrikes on Islamist positions in Libya, those didn't really work out well. But of course, the rationale for Egypt's intervention is that they've been invited in by the recognized, internationally recognized government of Libya to deal with an Islamist threat, which is exactly the request made by the Iraqi government to the United States to deal with the threat there. So parallels there, and it is kind of hard to escape some of those, even if I think that one of them is maybe slightly more legitimate than the other one. But, you know, this is what the United States most fears and has made possible, is these sort of unilateral interventions by everyone and their grandmother with a fighter jet, you know, just going in and taking, you know, taking out this problem or attacking that problem or whatever. And it's not going to solve any of these things. It's just not. These military strategies can't solve these problems long term. They're political problems, they're economic problems, they're resource distribution problems. And the minute that you start inviting these neighbors in, that's just neighbors settling old scores and trying to redraw boundaries. Like, as Nate said, you know, they used to do in Europe, whenever they wanted to redraw a boundary, they would just seize on a crisis and go in.
Seize Schleswig-Holstein or something, just grab it and add it to your country.
Exactly. And so, you know, is that really better than the, you know, the better than the neo-colonial approach or whatever? Is that even something to be doing? At this point, you got to really ask, like, what's the point of all these interventions? Where does it stop? I mean, there's the responsibility to protect doctrine, but we don't even apply that in situations where we could intervene very easily, like Central African Republic. That's a very low-level, unsophisticated conflict between very local, not internationally connected Christian and Muslim militias fighting each other. 1.5 million people displaced, thousands of people being killed, some of them being killed in front of French peacekeeping troops, and the French don't do anything. And, you know, it's playing out these situations again. But then, you know, if it's in the Balkans or in Kosovo or wherever, boom, we're in there right away, you know, whether we get UN intervention authorization or not. And then messing around in Iraq and stuff like that. So I don't really know, like, where is this headed? What's the line? What are we going to do now?
I'd also bring up an example of an intervention. This is more along the French lines, but the UK had a military intervention in the Sierra Leone Civil War in 2000, between 2000 and 2003. They had some people over there. But what ended up happening was you had a bunch of, I think, Irish patrol, like a patrol got captured. Then you would send in another, like, special team to get them out. And then, so that, I mean, that leads to further fighting. And I guess just reviewing the operation overall, there was, you know, definitely some benefits to it. They did assist in, I think, tracking down some people for war crimes tribunals, things like that. But obviously, you know, it's a, you know, Black Hawk Down type situation. You know, you get some of your guys captured, and then you have to send in more guys to free them, and just, and there's always dangers, even if you're just a quote-unquote peacekeeping operation, so.
Yeah, so what do you think in terms of, like, should there be a line against these sort of neighborly interventions? Is it better to have interventions from well outside the situation or closer to the situation? What is the UN's role, especially when the UN Security Council is persistently deadlocked? Is that still a legitimate source of authorization for these type of things?
Well, I think we're starting to recognize the extreme limitations of a UN Security Council that was constructed 75 years ago, almost. When you think about, okay, like, why are China and Russia on the Security Council? Okay, because in the aftermath of World War II. But would we be having these sorts of problems if it was Germany on the Security Council rather than China and Russia? You see what I'm saying? Like, you worry that the UN Security Council, and in many respects the UN altogether, is not necessarily the right actor to deal with these types of contentious, you know, civil situations. situations across the world. That doesn't mean that, you know, the five countries all bordering it, them invading or doing something is the best response either. So, I mean, it's just so many of these situations, you know, you sort of have to look at them. What exactly is going on? You know, who is interested? Who has beneficial interests rather than sort of self-motivated type, you know, where you're worried about like a land grab or something like that? Or are you worried about them trying to persecute various types of people in that country? So it just seems like you have to take it every step at a time. I mean, there's some intriguing elements of getting like neighboring countries to come in, but I also think having that as like your organizing principle of, you know, of your theories of international relations, and like that's a good idea. It's just okay, but like what happens when like Ethiopia comes and invades, and you got the Ethiopian Eritrean war because of like some border conflict, and it's like, oh, but we're protecting like the good. Remember, I mean, it was 2006. What was the
yeah, and like
there was like conflicts between like your Christians and Muslims too involved in that.
Yeah, well, the like Christian dominated Ethiopia sending ground troops into Somalia in like the end of 2006, early 2007,
and then Eritrea gets involved.
Yeah, well, Eritrea was like it, you know, as a Muslim dominated. So then they had proxy because they hate the Ethiopians. So they had proxy like fighting with, you know, funding this and arming the Somali guys, even though Eritrea is like dirt poor. So they were using all of their money on arms for Somalia instead of feeding their own people, just so they could kick out the Ethiopians.
You worry that if that starts happening with any degree of frequency, it's going to be basically the 1600s again. You just have like invade the duchy over there and we're going to go attack the palpitator, whatever. And just like, okay, this is crazy, but okay.
Yeah.
It's Crusader Kings too.
And also a lot of these things, it's ignoring the underlying problem of, well, why is this response happening? Why are people flocking to this movement? Why is there an uprising in the first place? And then you look, well, what can these sort of groups deliver? In the case of Somalia, they delivered an organized peaceful system for like 6 months or whatever. It was very repressive, but they at least like stabilized the situation. And you actually look at now the areas, the pretty small areas that are controlled by Al-Shabaab, which is, you know, supposedly one of the scariest terrorist organizations in the world. They are spending, you know, they're not spending $2.5 million to buy a dirty bomb to attack New York or whatever. They're spending $2.5 million buying construction equipment so they can dig irrigation canals and, you know, build highways and things like that so that they can actually have like development, like legitimate agricultural development of locally grown food in southern Somalia. Because, and they say, you know, we don't want any international food aid, not from anybody, not from the UN, not from some, you know, neutral friendly country, not from Sweden or whatever. We don't want food aid from anyone. Why? Not because it will make everyone dependent on us, but because it drives the price down of all the local food if there's this competing free food being brought in, and it destroys the local industry. So they're essentially setting up protective tariffs on agriculture effectively, and they are then putting in the resources and money to develop this agricultural sector, something you don't see happening in the other parts of Somalia that are under the Somali government's control or the African Union areas. And they're saying, look, we're going to build up this local area so that we don't have famines, so that we have a steady food supply and people are able to buy food locally and sell food locally and sustain themselves. And you go, okay, well, they're doing a lot of things that we don't like, but in the grand scheme of things, is this worse than the alternatives? Is this really all that bad? You know, should we automatically react with, you know, airstrikes or whatever every time that something happens? Like, we've got to start thinking a little bit more nuanced and big picture on some of this.
To be fair, there's really no government in Somalia, so.
Well, there is now. I mean, it's
right, but what I'm saying is, okay, any sort of plan made regarding agriculture is automatically more sophisticated than the complete lack of any sort of department that could formulate a plan on the Somali side. So, I mean, I see your point, but it's also kind of like, okay, well, obviously they built it because no one else was going to, if you see what I'm saying.
Right. All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation today.
Thanks a lot, Bill. This is a very good one.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.